The role of the actuary in data analytics. It's inevitably, we were talking about a little bit of it yesterday, but this session will certainly focus on it. The use of data analytics to gain insight and enhance business performance. The use of data analytics to hopefully make your job easier. Well, then again, it could be like carrying bricks. That's what we will explore over the next hour and a bit. Could you please welcome to the stage our three of our four wonderful volunteers. They are Alan Greenfield, Paul McCarney, Craig Price, and Simon Reed, who was on his way from the airport. He got caught up. Simon Reed is from Quantium. Now, if Quantium was nearly as good as they say, he would have known that was going to happen, and he would have got on an earlier plane. So I'll be challenging him when he gets here, but he's on his way and he will join us shortly. The way it works this morning, 15 minutes per speaker, and then after the four speakers, we do have Q&A. Yes, please, text your messages. Be prepared to ask them with the old microphone. Make my job easy for me, because by the second day, I'm barely here, really, or something like that. Our first speaker is Alan Greenfield. He co-founded Taylor Fry in 1999. He was the Actuaries Institute Actuary of the Year last year. For the pioneering role he played in developing the investment approach to social welfare. What a great speaker to kick off this morning. Please welcome Alan Greenfield.
Thanks, Michael. Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. I've got a massive topic, social policy and analytics, and just 15 minutes, so I'll jump right into it. Okay, so a disclaimer to start with. I was pretty poor at history at high school, so I think a lot of what's going on are world firsts and big change happening. But the world's a big place, and the ancient Greeks did a lot thousands of years ago, so if I make some outrageous claims that are wrong, I apologise. Okay, so what is some of the history of analytics and policy making? I found a reference to some evidence-based decision-making for driving policy from the 14th century. Unfortunately, the reference I found said nothing else other than that. I guess it makes sense that it was the 14th century. That was sort of the end of the Dark Ages, the beginning of the Renaissance. But it would have been nice to see exactly what the policies were and what the evidence was used. But certainly in terms of the last, the 20th century, there was plenty going on. Statisticians have been around forever doing cost-benefit analyses in the social policy world. So, you know, have a program, deputy secretary asks for a review of whether it works or not. So those sorts of cost-benefit analyses. Impacts of policy design, they've been around for a long time. We're talking, you know, at least the last 50 years. And then certainly targeting reviews of people who are being paid welfare benefits. That's been going on for a long time also. In an actuarial context in Australia and New Zealand, I know that when I started some 30 years ago in actuarial consulting, that my older colleagues had been working on scheme design for accident compensation for at least 10 years before I showed up. So it's 40 or 50 years that we've been designing schemes, accident comp schemes in Australia. And then in terms of student loans, that's been around for decades and actuaries have had involvement there. There are probably people in this room who are involved in the lifetime community rating for health insurance. And then more recently, the NDIS, and the head actuary there got the award I had to give up recently. Okay, so plenty going on for at least the last 50 years. So why the hell am I up here now? What's new that means I'm here to talk to you today? Well, I think there are some things that are new that are going on. Certainly the last 5 years and perhaps the last 10 have seen a lot of things come together, which mean that there's this whole new world of evidence-based decision-making in the social policy sector. So I've listed them, at least the ones that I sort of think are important on this slide. So Obviously, there's the technological side, strong advances in computing power and data storage and statistical techniques. And that's been a part of it. But we've needed these other factors to come along at the same time. So there's been a coming together of this idea around using a single metric as a way of understanding a whole sector in the social sector. So the one that's being used is the lifetime cost of individuals in the sector. There's a couple of stars, a star next to that, so we'll talk about that in a bit. It's not as simple all the time. The availability of data is coming along in leaps and bounds. Some of this has happened since we started in working in it, but there are now data platforms which make accessing all of this wonderful, rich, personal, government-type data available for analysis. I think there's been a recognition that the data is really important and that evidence is really important for policy making. The quote here is from Victor Dominello, the Minister for Innovation and something or other, and he said that data is one of the greatest assets held by government, but when it's buried, it's of little value. I think there's also been a public acceptance of the use of their personal information. Now, it might not be sort of completely accepted, but certainly if Generation X doesn't mind putting naked photos of themselves on Facebook, then I don't think they really care if we know a little bit about what payments they're receiving. And then there's also been an acceptance lately that trials are okay. When we first started working for the New Zealand government, we had a lot of discussions around wanting to do trials of new programs to test whether they really work, randomised control trials. And there's a lot of pushback initially about them being unethical. How can you possibly offer a service to some people and not others? And my response was always, well, if they can do it in the drug industry where life and death is at stake, then surely we can do it in the social sector. And I think the other point to bear in mind is we don't know that these things actually work, so why not test them? Maybe the people who aren't getting the services are better off. So I should also mention Bill English. He's sort of the driver in New Zealand of a lot of what's been going on, so he sort of deserves a round of applause. He's the finance minister, deputy prime minister, and he's been pushing using data. He's pushed building the data platform in New Zealand. He's pushed several of the major departments to undertake major exercises in using data to drive policy and operational change. Okay, so I mentioned on the previous slide that that there was this idea that you could use a sort of a single metric, the lifetime cost, as a way of understanding the behaviour of people in a system, in a social sector, and use that as a basis for driving change, understanding what's going on, innovating and so forth. So this is the sort of the caveat around that. So it works perfectly fine in the welfare system. The charts are just some, you know, pictures of people's journeys through the welfare system in New Zealand. It works fine there because what you really want to do is two things. You want to improve people's lives and you want to save money. And it turns out you can get people into employment. You can spend money to achieve that. You do lots of things good by doing that. You improve their lives. Turns out that there's lots of academic research that people are better off physically and mentally with a job. So we can do those good things, and at the same time you save money because otherwise you're spending a lot more on paying them welfare benefits. So that all works fine. But in justice and crime and in the social housing sector, it's not quite so simple. You can imagine that the criminal justice system has more features than just the financial fiscal costs of people being locked up. The system also provides society with a feeling of safety, of security and confidence that they're safe to walk about. And there are sort of non-financial consequences of getting things wrong. and it can be catastrophic consequences. So there are lots of things to take into account, and a fiscal lifetime cost measurement won't capture those. In social housing, the situation would be similar to welfare if there was an endless supply of social housing places, but there are not. Okay, there's a restricted supply of stock. So that means that the cheapest way to run the system is to let wealthy people use the stock and pay you market rent. But it doesn't do anything for the homeless people. So it turns out that if you boot people out of tenancies that are able to be independent and replace them with people who might otherwise be in the park, that actually costs you more, because those vulnerable people are likely to stay longer and need more assistance. But it only costs you more in the social sector of social housing. The other sectors you might save money. So you might save money in the mental health space, in emergency wards, in hospitals, and in ambulance transport costs if you find houses for people that would otherwise be using those other services. So, it's not as simple as the fiscal cost of people in social housing. You need to be careful about how it's used. So, all right, so show me some insight. What are the things that are being derived from all of this sexy analytics? So, just as background, we've been involved since 2011 in doing the welfare valuation in New Zealand. So that's looking at the lifetime cost of the 500,000 or so people who are on welfare benefits, and you know what the amount of funds needed to pay for those lifetime costs. We've also recently finished the first social housing valuation, which is due for release any time in the next few months. So the chart on the left I'll talk about, that's been around for a long time, and it still makes the hair stand on the back of my neck. It's one that shows that, now we all know that it can't be a good thing if young people are starting on welfare benefits, you know, the age of 18, 19. And we know that must be a problem, but no one, I think, knew how much of a problem it was. So this chart shows that 75% of the cost of the welfare system in New Zealand derives from people starting on benefits under age 20. So it really is such a big driver that that the government needed to do something. I won't talk about the one on the right other than to say it's showing the sort of multiple combination effects of things like a child, youth and family history, or a youth justice history, certain ethnicity, and so forth, and how they drive up costs more than an additive effect. What are policy changes that have been coming about because of analytics in the in this space? So I mentioned the youth issue in New Zealand. Now, I wouldn't say it was entirely because of the analysis that was done, but the policy that is and changes that have been going on in New Zealand have been to say invest a lot more in a youth service. We're talking tens of millions of dollars to help those that are at risk of long-term benefit receipt. One of the other major changes in New Zealand has been changes to work expectations for sole parents. New Zealand was very relaxed in terms of wanting sole parents to go back to work. You could be a parent with a youngest child aged 14 until the government expected you to start going back to work. They've reduced that to about 5, which brings them in line with the OECD. Now, it's not great analytics that maybe led to that policy change, but certainly because of the analytics, they're able to say how much there has been the impact of these changes. There's a query there with the Australian investment approach taking off at the moment, whether there might be some new assets tests for the Australian age pension. Okay, so measuring impact. So we can now do that. This chart shows the attribution of change from 2014 valuation to the 2015. And while, of course, there are grey areas, we are able to determine to a large extent what has been the impact of large policy and operational changes on the lifetime costs of welfare benefits in New Zealand. And over the 5 years that we've been doing the valuation, the welfare cost of welfare is reduced, future costs is reduced by about $12 billion related to just the policy and operational changes. There have obviously been other impacts due to economic changes. And that equates to 900,000 years less on benefit. All right, so where else is this stuff being used? So I mentioned that we've been working for the welfare and social housing sectors in New Zealand. They've also got projects underway on the justice system about sort of predicting crime, and now on just kicked off in the last 3 months or so on vulnerable children. In Australia, there's been the recent report on the welfare system. Obviously, the NDIS is using a lot of data to manage their system. And then health analytics is a space in Australia that gets that I see tenders all the time for. In New South Wales, we did some interesting work that made an appearance in the intergenerational report. That's the chart on the right. And that was about the 20-year costs of people leaving, or of kids really, leaving out of home care. So we have this foster care system where they get care up until age 16 or a bit older, and then they're on their own. And not surprisingly, that's not the best system. And those people who leave out of home care with lack of support end up costing a lot of money the New South Wales government. So there's a lot of effort going into what we can do there. All right, and almost perfect timing. I'm finishing up with a picture. It's been a roller coaster ride for me over the last 5 years. It was, unexpected journey. Started out with a late night drinking and a tender that had come out in 2011, and some silly fool in our office said, why don't we go for this? And the next day we remembered that we'd said that and we decided to go for it. And we've been working on it ever since, and I met the Prime Minister of New Zealand along the way and got that award. So it's been a lot of fun, and I hope I've shown you something of the journey. Thank you.
And a very impressive journey. There's $12 billion already. But you still can't tell us how we can beat the All Blacks. I mean, how good is this stuff, really?
Well, the All Blacks have better data analytics than we do.
Unfortunately, he's right. Plenty of questions just coming out of Alan's speech, Alan's presentation, let alone the next three. Next off, we have Paul McCartney, not Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney is an investor, entrepreneur in the digital technology, data and marketing space. Among other things, he's co-founder and CEO of Data Republic, as well as non-executive director of TradeMe and Sirius Meter, formerly Reed Business Information, previously an ed at iiNet. So, from the capitalism side, from the front row of making this all work and pay, please welcome Paul McCartney.
Thank you. So today I've been asked to come up and talk a little bit about something which Alan touched on, which is a data platform. And so some of you may or may not have heard of it. Various governments are starting to move into this space. People are starting to think about what Minister Dominello said, which is, how do we get this data that's underneath our mattresses and how do we get it onto our balance sheet or leveraged into our P&L? So there's a couple of capitalist words there thrown in for Michael's benefit. One of the things that I think is hard to think about when we talk about exchanging data is, how is that relevant for me? What data is out there? How is it relevant for the opportunities that we're trying to address? What are the risks that are associated with either unlocking the data that you've got or accessing the data that somebody else has got? And then the last thing I've been asked to talk about is just how have we solved it? How do we think about those problems?
What are some of the opportunities that, we think exist when that data gets unlocked? And that's not just for insurance, but for governments and other corporate institutions. The first thing I wanted to point out was McKinsey estimate the opportunity of open data to be about $3 to $5 trillion annually. And that's a lot of that's from productivity gains, but a lot of that is just through general efficiencies and monetization of data, not just from government. Actually, this is just from government, so we're not talking about unlocking value from data from insurance companies or from banks or from airlines or from grocery retailers. This is just from open data globally for governments to open their data up and allow people like you or other organisations to access it. The first thing I wanted to talk about was one of the opportunities for insurance is clearly informing policy premiums. And in the past, you know, we think about accessing GPS data, we think about black box technology, we think about how can that inform inform premiums, and some of you have initiatives in that, in this space already, but it doesn't come without a lot of risk. It doesn't come without re-identification risk. It doesn't come without risk associated with brand, or it doesn't come with government overreach and regulatory risk. And I guess that's true for most of the opportunities we'll talk about today. The other opportunity is just in health. Again, everybody's thinking about how this works and how this could work to inform premium decisions. But one of the real challenges is, you know, what rights does the consumer have with this data, and do they give it away, and who owns that? And you all might have read the 582 pages of the Productivity Commission review that's come out recently, or you may not have, but a lot of that points to how the government thinks about who owns that data, and whether we as consumers own it, or whether the organisations that collect the data, or when, at what point do we give that up? And the last point I wanted to make was, you know, geospatial data and weather data, again, a lot of you will be using that type of data to inform premium decisions, but the combination of many of these data sets, not just the weather data, not just the government data, not just the health data or the car data, but think about those when they come together, that could be incredibly powerful but also incredibly complex, and we all might pull our hair out thinking about how could we possibly make that happen. But that's because there's no infrastructure, and I'll talk about that a bit later on. Infrastructure is the key here. The technical infrastructure, the legal infrastructure to be able to make this happen is incredibly difficult, and I guess the thing that's missing in the marketplace today is trust. There's no trust between organisations, between government and companies to be able to make this happen, and again, I'll talk a bit about what's required to enable that towards the end. And the last one, you know, again, Alan touched on, is just personalisation, being able to create a policy specific for an individual. There are occasions where that's regulated against, and then the ability to map purchase behaviour to consumers via competitions, or the ability to bid on a consumer at a different rate based on their likely risk to your organisation, which could be different to somebody else's. And again, that is often to the benefit of the consumer. And so a lot of what we're talking about now are situations where, you know, the consumer wins in nearly every instance. They get a better service, they get better coverage, they often might get a better price. But most of what's withheld from the ability for insurance organisations to actually do that is data. And the data to make that personalised service offering is often not there. And again, we'll chat about that. How we think about solving that towards the end. And the last point I wanted to make is just around fraud identification and management, and banks look at it from a KYC AML perspective. You know, we're thinking about, you know, how we take credit reference data, social media data, and maybe even data from a repair shop, and think about really how can we bring those data sets together, match the variables, and ensure that there's no at least create a propensity to understand whether there's any fraudulent behaviour going on. Now, these are all examples of how insurance organisations can think about using other people's data or exchanging data with other organisations. But the bigger question is, where does the data come from? How do you actually access it? This is again a question of infrastructure, and it's absolutely a question of liquidity. And I'll talk about what's stopping you from accessing that data? Why don't you guys go out and do those deals? Why don't, and maybe a lot of you are doing deals with individual car shops, and it just becomes incredibly complex when you talk about the linear discussions that need to go on for one possibly small multilateral data exchange. And so that at the moment, we Data Republic thinks about the data that's available, I guess, across two axes, which is coverage, which is a census-style proposition, you know, where you're covering the 18 million adult Australians, but it's pretty dull data. It's not that deep, and then you've got express data. People are being asked questions. You know, Alan, are you going to eat more oats or more chocolate next week? And you'll more than likely say oats, but most people eat more chocolate, and we may have seen that play out, you know, in America more recently, but where people are a little bit scared about saying, well, I'm actually going to vote for Donald Trump, but actually what they ended up saying was, I'm going to vote for Hillary, and they end up voting for Trump. And so there's increasingly, challenges being made to that express data industry, and there's a huge gap in understanding, you know, what people are buying. This is in a privacy compliant way, how often they're transacting, whether they're vegetarian or not, whether they're going to fly overseas or not. If they're overseas, do they get their credit card cancelled? Can a bank share that data? Can the bank get the data from an airline to understand when I'm overseas so I don't get embarrassed when I'm having lunch and my credit card gets declined, or possibly I can tell them to cancel when my wife's overseas so we can stop her going hard on the Amex, which is not always positive. So, and then the other risk when you're looking at data exchange is time. So in the process of doing deals or putting an exchange together, if you're looking to do this on a bilateral basis, and this is how it started, I tried to do a bilateral data exchange on behalf of a board that I was on, and it became incredibly complex. I knew that the analytic at the output of it was quite simple. It might just be a match on a consumer to understand whether someone's browsed a site, a real estate website or a car website, just to understand, are they in the market for these vehicles or homes? And it turns out it's not a technical problem. You know, it's not technical because, you know, it's very easy to take a USB stick and give the data to somebody, and that's incredibly unsecure. And so that these USB sticks are still floating around. They're still being used by organisations to get data to consulting groups and inter-company data transfers because of the port issue in the firewalls, and we've got security locking the data down, and the way that we get around that is via USB sticks, and that's something that we want to change. So this problem of data exchange is a non-technical one. There's technical analytic components of it, and most of that is around discovery. Is the problem I've got correlated to the data that you've got? That's a challenge. But in terms of time to value, most of the value is at the end of the process. That time frame could be 6 to 12 months. And then the last one I want to talk about is just complexity. Again, I spoke before about the car example. Multilateral data exchanges between two or more than two parties, or even two parties, it's a nightmare to coordinate. It's very hard just for me and one other organisation to agree on terms. It's hard, let alone me and another organisation and then them. And security protocols, risk mitigation, how data gets deleted, management's time, legal contract risk, all of these things are things that historically have created the downfall of anyone trying to exchange data. And to do that in a regulatory environment which is relatively fluid is quite challenging. And again, it all comes down to one thing, which is trust. Nobody trusts each other. Now, we trust that when we take a credit card and we put it in a little tiny box, the vendor trusts that the money in that little bit of plastic is going to go into their bank when I get the bottle of water. That trust is inherent in our culture, but it wasn't always there. Minister Dominello said, yes, we're putting our data, we've got our data locked away in a vault. That data has a value, and we're not bringing that value out, and there's no trust in anybody accessing it. So think about money in the 1800s. Think about when there was no infrastructure for banking. We didn't trust anybody. Somebody came to ask for my money. I'm not sure whether I should give it to them. I'm not sure the lineage of that money, whether it's real or wasn't, whether it wasn't real. It's often in a hole in the ground. When I go to send it somewhere, it gets stolen by the stagecoach. There's no trust in the infrastructure for data, for data exchange, I should say. Increasingly less so for on-prem as well, given the fluctuations or the variations in various security protocols behind firewalls. And then, the summary of the challenges in an exchange are up there that you can read. One of the ones that I haven't spoken a lot about is how you activate it. How do you manage, once that data exchange is done, how do you manage the activation of that data on a daily basis? How does it get into your bidding platform for your acquisition? How does it get into your online premium tabulations? And then I guess up front you've got the issue of how do I understand, can I understand, I've got a problem I think can be solved with somebody else's data, but I don't really know. I don't really know that whether I've got a problem and their data can solve it. And so there needs to be a process of discovery and, as a result, valuation. And that valuation is really important, because valuation can vary based on who you are. A removalist might value the fact that I can help them understand when their customers are moving house. They might spend $100 per customer. An insurance organisation or a bank might spend thousands. And so valuation becomes important, and it becomes important not just for the organisation that wants to commercialise their data, but it becomes important because the data itself needs to be engineered, it needs to be understood, and it needs to be contextualised in a way which is sensitive to consumers' rights, but also that solves the problem that that the organisation is looking to solve. So, yep, that's understood. What we've done is we're looking to solve these problems by moving from an environment where organisations have a really relatively complex problem to solve to one where everybody opts into one set of infrastructure, one legal contract for anybody using or contributing data or partnering like Taylor Fry do with us to solve problems for their clients where they can access an environment that that data can solve in a way which allows the auditability from the contributor's perspective. How is my data being used? Where is my data right now? Every single exchange is one report. And if you're using the data, what's the lineage on that data? Where has it come from? And is it valid for the problem that I'm looking to solve? The last point there is that we've created infrastructure where we separate and de-identify the data. The PI goes into an environment behind Westpac's firewall, and you get a token back, and it's with that token that you work on the personalised insights in our environment inside a workspace which might be running Spark, it could be running Tableau, it could be running SAS, anything you're looking to look at discovering those insights on top of. And then I guess the last part is once we have that infrastructure and we have, you know, the deposit and the savings, if I'm to use that analogy, the infrastructure of data is, and we're starting to build trust, the thing that we've launched recently is a marketplace where we can start to promote liquidity in data, and we can start to have people using data in a way which is sensitive to consumers' rights, and doing it in a way where there's decreased risk of exchange, because where there isn't, you're going to end up with stagecoaches carrying money around and that money and data being taken, and you'll see Big W overnight and Adult Friend Finder in the US. There's increasingly going to be more and more risk around PI and around people accessing and exchanging data. So I hope that's been useful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul. So if you put that together with the first presentation from Alan, we're already underway in a big way. Craig Price leads the data science team within Suncorp's Chief Data Office. What that means is he's got a team of scientists, actuaries and statisticians who've got the job of embedding advanced analytics in the design process. If you have a team of scientists, data scientists, actuaries and statisticians, the parties just go off. There's an allegation that the inspiration for the Big Bang Theory was, in fact, Craig Price's outfit. Let's find out. Craig.
How can I live up to that intro? Well, good morning, everybody. I guess, yes, following on from Alan and Paul, I guess, you know, I'm here to share the perspective of, you know, somebody working within an organisation, a general insurer, and in particular in the data science field. And from what I can see, there's enormous value that is still there to be leveraged from data science in the GI context. In addition to traditional areas of strength, which everybody would be aware of, you know, around pricing or valuation or some of the work done in capital, I think there are three areas that I want to sort of put in front of you today for actuaries and data scientists to drive even further value for the GI organisations that you're serving. First of all, following on and very, very in line with what Paul's been sharing with us, connecting new and richer sources of data from across your organisation as well as then externally. The second thing is there is enormous value still in embedding advanced analytics and ultimately cognitive and advanced AI into your wider set of processes across the organisation. And here we're thinking about things like customer and digital and then operational areas like claims, fraud, distribution and even things like HR departments. But finally, and it can't be underestimated, the importance of transforming the organisational business culture in terms of into one that is truly data-driven and where data is kind of at the centre of the way that decisions are made. Excuse me. And while the data science world is increasingly multidisciplinary, actuaries with their unique combination of skills and mindset have a critical role to play. So in my brief presentation today, I'd like to talk through some of the key elements that I think are critical to achieving this fabulous future and drawing from some of my own organisation's learnings and journey in the journey to date. So one of the key elements in getting serious about analytics is having support from the top. You know, this is critical because it drives the right preconditions around funding and prioritisation and culture. I work for Suncorp. It's a financial services organisation providing insurance, banking and wealth management services to almost 9 million customers across Australia and New Zealand through brands such as AAMI, GIO, Shannons, Vero and others. Under the sponsorship of our then group CEO, our organisation decided in 2014 that it was going to do something about the untapped potential of our data. And it created a chief data officer role along with a new team and a new program of work. Recent stats from Forrester would suggest that roughly 45% of surveyed organisations would have a similar role. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have to have a CDO to be able to get the data transformation that we're talking about here. Oops. But certainly there are other ways of doing it in terms of, you know, fostering communities of practice or other structural mechanisms to be able to get this happening. Suncorp CDO supports an entire group of, you know, from a data sourcing and platform point of view, but also provides a spectrum of analytical services from dashboards and reporting all the way up through to data science solutions for all of the group functions outside of the traditional actuarial pricing and credit functions. These groups remain separate but work collaboratively with the CDO. And the CDO has a broad range of BI professionals that also includes, as you've heard, actuaries, you know, statisticians and data scientists. The original mandate for the new group was to consolidate, simplify and transform our data. In other words, the CDO was going to bring all of the data into one place, consolidate fragmented analytical capability and simplify our legacy warehousing environment. And finally, to transform the organisation to being truly data-driven from moving our resources away from the kind of BI traditional reporting and into higher value add and advanced analytics. And so while we're only partway through the data transformation journey, we do have quite a different organisation from a few years ago. And in particular, the significant changes we've seen are that the CDO role in itself is now an effective voice, an effective advocate at the strategic level for investment in group-wide data and analytics. And this role works well in conjunction with the related focus of the chief actuary. We also now have a significant asset in our group data lake and emerging cloud platform, and there's an increased focus on customer and insurance claims analytics. And finally, there's been investment in big data for the next wave of value. So I hope you like this slide about our data lake, and you've got some you know, wonderfully diverse fish swimming around in there. And, you know, no doubt in your journey you will also have some strange beasts from a data perspective that land in your warehouse, or sorry, in your lake. But creating a trusted source of raw and transformed data is critical to be able to drive value from exploring and connecting new data across different domains. It'd be fair to say that the consolidate and simplify phase of our journey has been hard work. We acquired more than 100 of our internal sources into the lake and have decommissioned 7 core data warehouses so far. but hard work, but it's important stuff. It's critical to get the resources, you know, to acquire the breadth of data into your lake, especially non-traditional sources, such as things like customer interactions from your digital and human channels. But it's no use having a lake unless the data can be searched and accessed in an appropriate format by users and ensure that they're, by users and appropriately governed with security and access controls. The next phase of our build, though, is trying to enable and make it easy for our users to find the data that they're looking for and ensure that they're not duplicating assets that have already been built. The other key element of anyone's data strategy, of course, is your approach to external data. And you've heard a bit from Paul just now. And as you've heard, there's many options out there to connect your organisation's data with other insights to more powerfully understand the risk and behaviour of your customer base. Now, from an internal data science team point of view, the complementary capability is to be able to rapidly measure the value that is provided by the various external data options. In many cases, you know, it's going to be a significant investment. And so, basically, having a capability that can quickly evaluate new sources of data and give strategic advice around, you know, the likelihood of an investment paying off or not is important. So you really need to have a process to measure uplift relative to your base models that are excluding that data. Nirvana is clearly having an environment that can semi-autonomously evaluate the uplift when you just throw new data into your modelling process. Everyone probably now on day two is familiar with the three big Vs of data, so volume, variety and velocity, and I'm not going to labour the point. In fact, some of you out there will probably say, no, there's four or seven Vs or even more Vs. But the significant changes we're seeing are actually talking to an increasing need to play with large data volumes, high variety, and increasing need for real-time analytics, especially when we're talking about customer-facing applications. So you've got to have a high-performing analytical environment that can cater for these use cases. Our strategy has been to leverage cloud platforms to provide scalability at an appropriate price point. From a big data perspective, we've got a Hadoop-based environment. And the focus this financial year is in acquiring the big sort of core data sets to further build out the tooling to make it easy for our data scientists and actuaries to work with unstructured data in a parallelized computing environment. And like many here, no doubt, we're finding great value in using the open source tool sets like R and Python, Spark and Scala to wrangle and model our big data. So you've got your data accessible and you've got a platform to crunch it, but next you have to have the tools and processes to effectively turn that data into dollars. And many of you here will be familiar with the data science pipeline or workflow that's presented here, or some variation of it. There's many ways of presenting it. And you start off basically with collecting your data and connecting it, internal and external. But next, there's a process around munging or pre-processing the data. This includes cleaning, categorising, binning, but importantly also the engineering of features, which you can think of as specific transformations of data elements. Next up is building the predictive models itself and the critical step of validating the performance of those models. But then, in many cases, the predictive model is not the thing itself. You know, you've got rules or calculations or algorithms that have to sit on top and determine what price or action to take as a result. So finally, in closing the loop, you've got to be able to deploy and then monitor the models and algorithms. And then the circle goes around again, or at least it should, depending on the value of the process that you're modelling. But a few observations. So first of all, don't underestimate the power of getting unique data to help understand a particular process that you're modelling. After a certain level of modelling sophistication, new data may really bring that step change in performance rather than trying to squeeze, you know, blood out of the stone from just doing more modelling refinement. Similarly, the power around feature engineering. Those of you who are playing in the Kaggle platform will often find that people are rapidly converging on similar sets of algorithms and ensembling. The real game there is to be able to actually wrangle the data and use interesting feature engineering to actually get, you know, a leg up on the competition. Another observation is that, you know, we haven't seen yet an out-of-the-box modelling suite that does all of this from an end-to-end basis in a big data perspective. But I know that various people and organisations are onto it. But ultimately, a successful organisation needs to have this pipeline significantly automated, albeit with expert overview from an analytical point of view. But ultimately, AI algorithms are going to be actually working across individual steps. So in terms of the ingestion and the cleaning and the feature processing, there'll be actually algorithms that are actually running those processes. And also then sort of, you know, governing the entire process itself. And I think that's an interesting development. And our focus this year has actually been to focus on the feature engineering piece so that our analysts can actually ingest some of the larger data sets and actually get, you know, making value out of them quickly. Many people will know that there's a whole new area of interest in the field of cognitive computing and artificial intelligence. Some people are calling it machine intelligence. It's a really hot field, with Forrester predicting AI investments next year to be triple those of this year. And startups are being bought out by the big players like IBM and Apple, Google, and even Samsung now bringing out a chatbot. Earlier this year, I attended what was billed as Australia's first artificial intelligence seminar targeting commercial organisations. So the game is on and the hype is big. The question is, you know, is this technology going to deliver to its promise? Well, I believe it will, because the promise of AI is not just being able to get deeper insights, it's also the ability to drive a whole new wave of data democratisation, where business users are going to be able to get to their data-driven insights easier and without heavy involvement of technical staff. And in this slide, I reference the way that IBM thinks about cognitive computing, because they've summarised it really well. They define cognitive computing as systems that learn and naturally interact with people. And you can see the skills there, that from the left-hand side, you've got adapting and learning, which is pretty much the bread and butter of what machine learning does already. But as you go around, it sort of adds the capability around understanding and also generating natural language. And the final capability there is one where the multiple possibilities are generated and evaluated. So this is going to give a nuanced understanding of the uncertainty and also the alternatives around the particular situation being analysed. Many will be familiar with cognitive applications like Apple Siri, but other use cases are finding their way into the enterprise, such as customer servicing, being able to interact seamlessly with customers to answer questions or take an initial set of information from customers. But additionally, these capabilities are being used to power core decision-making, as well as powering analytical tools for less technical users. Our understanding is that many financial services service organisations are still reticent to make large investments in AI, and we think that this is given the cost and potentially due to a lot of other lower-hanging fruit being prioritised first in the analytical world. But it is coming, and the cost of the capability will also decrease. In the meantime, we do know that organisations are powering ahead with robotic process automation, given the tangible nature of the quick result and the relatively smaller cost to deploy. But RPA is going to meet up with the smarts from cognitive systems, in my view, and not too far away. So we've talked a bit around the what, but now back to the how, and it comes back, you know, clearly to the talent you can get. And so apologies for this early, you know, giving you this visual, but how good would it be, you know, when you've got a world of actuaries and data scientists that were as desirable as Calvin Klein models? I think we're all working towards that glorious future. Given the diverse and highly technical nature of the data science domain, I think it's wise to build a network of talent and advice in various subspecializations, and also to leverage industry meetups provided by the actuarial and data science communities. But in terms of building out your own team, who do you need on your starting 11? Shown here is a slightly busy four-way Venn diagram that suggests that the ideal data scientist is one that has a high degree of competence in four areas, being stats, programming, business domain expertise, and also communication. It's interesting that the skills of the ideal data analytics actuary aren't a million miles away from this. Actuaries also come with the benefit of having a holistic framework of understanding systems and business processes and the risks and uncertainties inherent in those systems, and so that's a great skill and mindset to bring to the data science practice area. But I think more important than just ticking off those four kind of capabilities is the abilities, some of the attributes that can transcend those component skills. And so my experience is you've got a critical need for people in your team that can solve difficult problems, where there's no historical precedent, there's no recipe to follow. The attribute of a curious mind that's not content with the status quo has been well highlighted, and I'm in full agreement. And then finally, you need people in your team that have the skill to be able to break through organisational blockers, be it political or technology or issues of funding and resource prioritisation. And while you should absolutely work on getting, you know, these so-called unicorns into your team, the mythical beasts that have got all these capabilities in one humble person, they do exist, but they're rare. So more realistically, as you scale up your team, you're going to have the ability to get talented people that maybe nail one or two of those areas into your team. And then by getting the right balance, you're going to have the perfect data science capability overall in your delivery squads and also benefit from a diversity of perspective in the team. We're out of time. This was basically just, you know, to talk through a little bit around data science and design thinking around, you know, you really do need to pick the right use cases to demonstrate the power of your data. So we'll flick past this, but I would leave you with the idea about thinking through the whole desirability, viability, feasibility nexus in what you knock off. And potentially, if you're not set up for success, walk away, you know, rather than, you know, have a tough time actually proving value. So I think just to finish off, let's talk quickly about the use cases and the opportunities for GI actuaries. And I think that, you know, first of all, using all of your enterprise data to be able to understand your customers is an enormous, enormous capability, enormous opportunity. We're working on a project called Next Best Action. And at the end of the day, that's really all about personalization of the customer interactions that we have. The company is basically focusing on creating value for our customers. This is a stated aim of our new CEO. Rather than historically, people would have talked about, you know, what's the value we can extract from our customers, and that's sort of, you know, taboo now. It's actually about creating value for the customers. So how can you use data and analytics, internal and external, but to be able to serve that up in a way that's meaningful around services and around what is the appropriate conversations and what are the appropriate offers and actions at the right time that actually work for your customers? So we're actually working on those projects, and there's, you know, there's enormous value in there. And then quickly, I think, you know, this talks about, you know, the customer satisfaction and the revenue side of things, but other opportunities are certainly on the operational areas that we talked about, so claims and fraud. Projects there range from the very straightforward kind of predictive modelling side of things through to some of the more, you know, pushing the boundaries about how far you can take these things. So, for instance, in injury claims, can we use analytics to help claim staff recognise when a claim is off track and give some guidance around what to do? And this is a hard problem to solve, because from a modelling point of view, there's no target variable. There's not a zero or a one, basically, in your data. So how do you define an off-track claim? Is the claim off-track because it's external, i.e. the claimant's got something to do with it, or your own poor claims management? And how do you interpret past data to tell the difference so that you can model that desired trigger? And how do you do this when processes and potentially scheme legislation is changing? But despite the challenges, these are great projects to work on. And we've certainly got now an initial solution in place, and we'd sort of recommend others to think in similar directions. Finally, we're dipping our toe into some cognitive experiments, and we've talked about documents and text and voice data. But it's interesting about how easy it is to actually get these experiments up. API platforms like IBM's Watson is incredibly cheap and simple to use. You know, anyone that can program in R can actually download a library and ping, you know, your data off to their platforms and get a response back in terms of, you know, personality insights or tone analyzer or other natural language little widgets. And finally, the capability of smart dashboards is one that we're really keen on. The time has really come to go past the normal dashboard and reporting concept and have tools that automatically generate commentary that looks behind the particular trend and basically telling what are the key factors that have actually contributed to the unexpected variance in a particular metric or trend. And there's increasingly interest in this space with new products being released, like Watson Analytics into Cognos, but also just recently Sydney actuarial startup HyperAnna has created an artificial intelligence-based visualisation platform that answers natural language questions about information in corporate systems. And that's a great capability. So look, my time's basically up. I could talk to you also about working with Innovation Labs, but I hope this has given you a little bit of an insight into our journey and some of the important factors as you consider and continue your own way forward in this domain. So thanks.
Thank you, Craig. And one of the questions that will obviously go to Craig when we get to the questions section is, what role is there for actuaries when you have all that artificial intelligence doing the job for you, I suppose? You could join journalists and being massively unemployed, something to look forward to. No. Quantium. Look, everyone knows the story of Target, the Target store in the US, which found out that the girl was pregnant before her father did. Quantium's aiming to find out when the girl will get pregnant. That's the ambition. Simon Reed was in at the birth of Quantium. He is responsible for Quantium's technology area, covering all aspects of application and data engineering. Please welcome Simon Reed.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Big data. The last 5 years, we've seen it go from a buzzword, a real buzzword, to a household name that's got so many V's after it now that you don't really know what's going on. So I'm here to talk about sort of a little bit more on the technology side, as the intro might have given away. And then really our journey into big data, which started three years ago. And I'm going to start with a little bit about the why on big data for Quantium. What's a presentation at an actuarial conference without a Venn diagram, eh? We like to consider ourselves as a market leader in applied analytics. So when we talk about applied analytics, it's really about extracting value out of the data. There's not many data sets that you can just look at, pick up, do nothing to it, no processing, no analysis, and just they're valuable by themselves. Most of the time, the data has to be processed, has to be cleansed, has to be analysed before you can actually get any value out of it at all. Applied analytics is all about taking that processing, taking all that analysis, harnessing it, and pointing it at a business problem. We see it as the intersection of three key areas. I like to think of them as three pillars. You've got your data, your data science, and your technology. All of those pillars are equally important. The stronger the pillars, the stronger the analytics that's going to sit on top. You can pull one of the pillars away or you can weaken down one of those pillars. You can still get a result. You can still get an analytical result, but it might not be as good. It might not be as personalised. You might be up at the segment level, whatever it is. I like talking to actuaries and people in the general insurance industry. You guys have been doing this for a long time. You guys get it, so it's good. You don't have to explain too much more about the why on using data and making data-driven decisions. There's a timeline for us, and I put it up just to describe the changing environment, the changing landscape that we had and we had to deal with as a technology department. So when we opened our doors back in 2002, we would typically do one-off consulting projects, which always started with, we will get some data, we'll cleanse it, we'll transform it, we'll analyse it, we'll do a predictive model on it, we'll find some insights, we'll put them into a, insights pack, and then we'll present that. And we still do a lot of that work today. But if you fast forward that through to today and, two or three years ago when we started our big data journey, we started bringing on these data partners and these execution partners, and that brought new challenges for us as a technology department with each one. So firstly, just the volumes of data just started blowing out. So what we used to do our sort of one-off projects for, you'd probably consider those small data sets by today's standards, and you'd also probably have a sort of a one-off manual pipeline that you'd run. You might run it a few times, but it was a pretty manual pipeline. Fast forward that through today, we've got every single transaction from electronic transaction from NAB customers for the last 10 years. We've got every single Woolworths electronic transaction that's going through. We've got every single remote click from Foxtel. So the volumes of data are just blowing out everywhere. Add on top of that, we have all our data scientists who are growing in number as well and growing in use of the actual data itself. The techniques that they're applying are also growing. We're also growing in complexity. Not just the techniques, but the way that it was actually being applied as well. So less upfront design, more sort of test, learn, test, learn, test, learn, test, learn, lots of really fast iterative batches. Add to that, you've got privacy and security. So, you start bringing on these sorts of data sets, as we've heard before, the privacy and security, everything starts to, get more and more tight, and the needs will be becoming greater and greater being put on us as a technology department. And then I think probably one of the biggest differentiators was the idea of an always-on data pipeline. So instead of running one-off manual data pipelines, we're constantly having data coming through, being cleansed, being transformed, being analysed, kicked through a predictive model, scoring engine, and then being spat out the other end. Whether that be to a supplier of Woolworths through our checkout tool, where they can look and see all the transactions with a customer lens on, or to a machine on a client side where it's sort of integrated with one of their systems. The idea of having an always-on pipeline was very challenging. So while this is our journey, I think as an industry, for most industries with data, it's sort of pretty reflective of what's happening and what has happened over the last 15 years with the data explosion. So we looked at ourselves and we said, in the words of Martin Brody from Jaws, well, we're going to need a bigger boat. We had a vision of an analytics platform that could do what we wanted to do, not just now or at the time. We had very specific needs. We had report run times on our checkout product, which we wanted to sort of, you know, bring down tenfold. But we also had a lot of things that we could see coming in the future with this explosion of data, things that we wanted to do, and we didn't want to be limited in the platform. We wanted to be able to do whatever you know, we wanted to be able to do, which is applied analytics. So where do you start? Well, first of all, we started with the big data landscape. This is the 3.0 version, which is 2014 version, I think. And it's pretty daunting to look at. It's really complex, very fragmented. You've got, you know, niche players in every little part. You've got nobody sort of in the analytical space just giving you an entire platforms out of the box saying, there you go, use that platform. Because our vision wasn't just for a platform for exploratory purposes, it was also for execution, so we could actually explore and run production jobs on exactly the same platform. So we did all our investigations, and down at the bottom of the stack, we chose Cisco as our hardware. Our data partners have certain security requirements that mean the data needs to be housed in a certain way. So we had to go with an on-prem solution. So we chose Cisco as our hardware provider and really customized the actual hardware that we're using in that. We chose Hadoop and specifically MapR's distribution of Hadoop for its security. And that became our distributed engine. And third-party technologies to get it all to work. So there's things like Yarn, which are resource negotiators and those sorts of things, which you basically just have to put on that platform to get things to work. So we had a 200-node cluster across two data centers, 5 petabytes of storage, 50 terabytes of RAM, 9,600 CPU cores. So a fair bit of grunt, fair bit of storage. You know, that's hopefully going to do us for a little bit of time before we start moving on to something else. But what we realized was we had an engine and a chassis, but that doesn't really take you anywhere. We needed things like seats, a steering wheel, and most importantly, brakes and seat belts. So we had to actually build out ourselves the last two layers of our Mustang platform, which are an operating layer. And the operating layer is all about making sure that as you scale out your use cases of the platform, you don't have to scale out your people that are actually managing the platform. Those people are actually quite scarce, as we saw before. They're quite scarce people to find in terms of the IT industry. And it's all about making it so that your data scientists don't have to actually be complete experts in all those layers below and all the goodness below. All they need to do is be able to use the tools in the application development layer, which is the other layer, and we can bring those tools to the data instead of bringing the data to the tools, which is really where, you know, the big data world's starting to move. Bring the tools to the data, don't bring the data to the tools. All right, so I just wanted to share a few of our learnings and, you know, through this experience of building out this platform. So firstly, open source. We heard about open source a little bit before. Open source is great. It's free. Everyone loves open source. Some things to bear in mind if you're going to use open source technologies. So I think what open source is really good at is setting standards really, really quickly. So with Apache Hadoop and Apache Spark, we've seen that happen, basically. Everybody starts integrating, all the other open source technologies start integrating with these central technologies, and suddenly they just become the standard. And that's faster and faster and faster than any other sort of, you know, proprietary kind of platforms. The access to the open source technologies is really, really easy, obviously. Sometimes integration's hard, though. Sometimes these third-party, you know, open source technologies, they don't play nicely in the rest of the environment. Open source developers love fixing things, and they like fixing things quickly, but sometimes you can't guarantee they're going to fix your problem. They might go fix a whole bunch of other problems, so you can't really... Yeah, you never guarantee, even if you're paying for support sometimes, you never actually guarantee that the problems are going to be fixed in time or in your time. You can always go in and fix them yourselves because it's open source, but then you also have to have the skill set on board to actually go in and fix the open source problems. So all in all, open source is great, but just bear in mind there are a couple of things that you've got to be wary of when using it. This second learning is all about, architect for fast pace. This is a really fast-moving environment in terms of technology. This is not your standard IT environment where you might have a major release every 6 months, a major release every 12 months. For Spark, while we were building our first application out on the platform, it might have had six releases, you know, every couple of months, which is really, really good because they're building new stuff all the time, but trying to incorporate that in, make sure that, you know, your testing processes are right, make sure you've got the actual architecture so you can test the new one while still running the old version in production, all those kinds of things, it needs to be architected for right up front. Interestingly enough, Spark was actually described to us once by one of the fellows at MapR as a jet fighter in kit form. He said, it's so powerful, but you've got to build it yourself, and then you've got to learn how to fly it yourself. So I think that's probably a fair summary as well. So another interesting point, it's just probably back to the open source point as well, is there's a lot of reasons for technologies to fail in this industry. Like that momentum builder, as I said before. If you're not the one, if you're not the technology that everyone starts integrating with, you can easily fail. You have people, if they just sort of move to a different direction, then the technology is obsolete. So in terms of your architecture and the way that you're thinking about your platform, you need to not hang your horse on a technology that's only just come out, because you never know. It might be gone in 2 or 3 months' time, 6 months' time, 12 months' time, whatever it is. In terms of building out the team, this is another learning we had. The mindset is a bit of a shift in the big data world. So your traditional data engineer or data developer, we found that the big data world, engineering is more like software engineering as opposed to traditional data engineering. So that was a bit of a mind shift. We found that our software engineers would jump over to the big data world and become data engineers in the big data world much faster than our traditional SQL or SAS data engineers would make that jump. Also, that our analysts and our data scientists, they also have to start thinking about things in a different way. Start understanding how you're going to get your queries to perform, and how you might structure your queries, and all the different other languages that are available to you in the big data world. And the last one there is the really niche skills. So it's really hard to find in the IT industry the people with the experience to build out platforms of this sort of nature. All right, so what's the payoff for us? So the payoff is things like this, basically. When I said we wanted a platform that could do things that we wanted it to do, the payoff is powering Woolworths offers that go out on their emails through a truly personalised engine. Every single customer has an offer based on their individual behaviour. That's 14,000 decisions on every single customer every single time we run the scoring engine. So 420 trillion decisions in total, which, as you can see up there, if every person in the world, if we harness the decision-making power of every person in the world, it's 15 decisions per second just to keep up with that. And we're wanting to run that more. We want to run it with more decisions, and we want to run it on a much more frequent basis. So just to wrap up, I think we're all up here because data is a disruptor, no matter what the industry is. I think getting your hands on as much data as you possibly can, whether it be IoT, Fitbits, whether it be unstructured data, like stuff from your call center, whether it be web browsing data, whether it be social media data, social media feeds, Getting your hands on as much data as possible, it's par for the course these days. Everyone's just assuming that's what you're doing. What's shifting is the buzzword's not big data anymore, the buzzword's real-time. And not just real-time dashboards, real-time execution. So the days of batch processing, I think, are getting numbered, and the days of sort of fitting your models or refitting your models, refitting your algorithms every quarter, every 6 months, that's old school as well. The technology exists these days so you can do that, and you can do it all the time. So when I was over in the US a little while ago at MapR's customer advisory board, real time was all anybody was talking about. So streaming and real time execution is the now and is going to be the next sort of, you know, few years of where this industry's going. So if you're not ready for that, or you're not getting yourselves ready for it, you are running the risk of getting left behind. Thank you.